I am delighted to introduce this year's speaker, Dr. Donald W. Shriver, President Emeritus of Union Theological Seminary in New York City. The title of Dr. Shriver's lecture today is Honest Patriots, Loving a Country Enough to Remember Its Misdeeds, and is based on his recent book by the same title, published by Oxford University Press and translated into German last fall. The paperback edition appeared just a few weeks ago and is available at Splendored Light Books here in Charlottesville, which is over in the Center for Christian Studies, as it would be available in other bookstores possibly as well. Dr. Shriver was born in the great state of North Carolina and was drafted into military service during the last year of World War II. After completing his service, he majored in history at Davidson College in North Carolina and continued on to Union Theological Seminary in Virginia, Yale University Divinity School, and Harvard University, where he completed his doctorate. He is an ordained pastor in the Presbyterian Church in the United States. Before being elected president of Union Theological Seminary in 1975, he was the first Southerner to hold that position of president of Union New York City. Dr. Shriver taught at North Carolina State University and at Emory. In 1991, Dr. Shriver retired as president of Union to teach applied Christianity in that great faculty, a faculty that once included, of course, Reinhold Niebuhr and Paul Tillich. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was there for a few months, and accepted adjunct appointments at the Jewish Theological Seminary, Drew University, and the Schools of Business, Law, and Journalism at Columbia University. Dr. Shriver is the author of numerous books. In addition to Honest Patriots, many of you will know some of his other works, An Ethic of Forgiveness, An Ethic for Enemies, Forgiveness in Politics, which came out with Oxford in 1995, and a little book I love, The Lord's Prayer, A Way of Life, that came out in 1983 with John Knox. Dr. Shriver is married to Peggy Shriver, a poet and ecumenical leader who is here with us today. Welcome, Peggy. And they are the parents of two sons and a daughter. Some of you may have read some novels by their daughter, Lionel Shriver, who is a prominent novelist who lives in London and New York. In this historic election year, I am pleased that this renowned public theologian has returned to his native Virginia to help us remember and recommit ourselves to honesty and probing self-reflection in the disciplines of his responsible citizenship. Don Shriver offers us cautionary words against hiding from difficult truths and shoring up our borders with an allegiance to ideals that diminish rather than promote human flourishing. Bill Moyer is the Baptist minister and one of our most beloved observers of culture and politics, said of Honest Patriots, "The book shines with the love of America that embraces our ideals without denying our flaws." Indeed, Dr. Shriver's invitation to think and act as global citizens has never sounded more welcome or urgent. Don, we thank you very much for accepting our invitation to the 2008 CAPS Lecture. Thanks all of you for coming out on this warm October afternoon. We look forward to our time together.
Thank you. I think that few could know how special this occasion is for me because it is an important place in my autobiography. My father graduated from the University of Virginia in 1924. He had a joint degree in liberal arts and law. His second year here, 1920, was the year in which the first women were permitted to come to this university, its graduate schools. Permitted, I'm sure, grudgingly, but permitted. From then until now, the reputation of this university has rightly grown into national and international prestige. But for me and personally, visiting this lawn and range in this building in the 1930s with my father, and hearing his pride of having been here for those 5 years, put into my biography an indelible sense that this was an important place. He was the only one of 5 brothers to graduate from college. His pride in this place was tangible in all the years of his life. He often said that his happiest years were spent here at the university. I'm not sure my mother liked that judgment. I myself would not imitate that judgment concerning my 4 pre-marriage years at Davidson College. His pride in this university, however, was part of his identity as a Virginian for the last 85 years of his life. The first 11 years he had spent in Baltimore and Washington. He would have liked to have claimed he was Virginia-born. His father, my grandfather, had a work associate in the early 1900s whose daughter had been born in Washington, D.C. A few days after her birth, he took his little girl across the Potomac and rubbed Virginia dirt on her backside. It's a humorous story and a true one, but it resonates with a fact that adorns and afflicts the culture of this state. A Boston friend of ours commented not long ago to me, "You must have been born in Northern Virginia, so you are not a real Virginian." I was surprised at how assertively I replied to him, "No, I was born in Norfolk." How many mixtures of memory and forgetting of Virginia history represented here in this audience, I cannot say. Charlottesville and this university are host now to a cosmopolitan assembly of persons old and young to this history. No doubt the consciousness of history in the minds of many Southerners is an annoyance to immigrants into the South from other regions of the country and the world. On the whole, Americans are not very patient with the past. We love the future. Well, there's lots of the Southern past not to love. I like that story that James Dabbs of South Carolina introduced me to, and which appears in Shelby Foote's Long History of the Civil War. James Longstreet was leading a line of his army along some road in Virginia, and he drifted back to the end of the line and saw there a soldier who was struggling along just scarcely. And with empathy, the general leaned down from his horse and said, "Will you make it, soldier?" And the soldier replied, "I'll make it, general, but I hopes to God I never loves another country." Well, to love a country in both its bright and its dim past in some mixture is a difficult combination. Memory is very persistent in Southern culture, partly because of the pains in it as well as in the glories in it. Pains of the past stick in personal and collective memory. A Mississippian, a guest professor in this university, put the Southern point of view succinctly when he famously said in his acceptance of the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1950, "The past is not dead and gone. It isn't even past." Well, he bespoke the theme of my book, Honest Patriots. The book documents in the life of 3 countries, Germany, South Africa, and the United States, the difficulty and the necessity of refreshing public memory of past events which most publics would prefer to forget. Who wants to remember the misdeeds of one's ancestors? Why take care to do so when the challenges of the present and the future press in upon us? One ethical answer is, the misdeeds most necessary to remember are those which still afflict living descendants of those most harmed by those misdeeds. To express that ethic in terms of political wisdom, one has to say that not to share the same memories with one's fellow citizens is to some degree not to be really their fellow citizens. I defy any new arrival in Charlottesville, for example, to try living here without so much as a word of praise or blame for Thomas Jefferson. You can criticize Jefferson here, but you'd better not disdain the memory of him. And you should not have come to this lecture in this place. Well, the central truth is about all societies, illustrated in three of them in my book, is that shared and omitted memories constitute large contents of public political culture. Included, of course, are the memories of past of which a people has every right to be proud. In his recent book, A Life in Transition, his autobiography as a major political leader in contemporary South Africa, Alex Baran says of his role as deputy chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that perhaps we should have paid more attention in that commission to good stories of the apartheid era, the heroic acts of people of all races who struggled against the racism. Telling the good stories is no small part of political rhetoric, and historians can help us remember them along with the not-so-good stories. A combination of proud and painful memories marks the most competent of histories. An illustration quoted early in my book comes from an essay by C. Van Woodward, Southern historian, translated from Louisiana to Yale. His 1953 essay entitled The Irony of Southern History is drawn directly from his reading of a book by Reinhold Niebuhr published the year before, The Irony of American History. It's easy for Americans all to forget that in the decade of Jefferson's death, there were more anti-slavery societies in the Upper South than anywhere in the North. About that decade, Van Woodward writes, it's not too much to say that this was a society unafraid of facing its own evils. The movement reached a brilliant climax in the free and full debates over emancipation in the Virginia legislature during the session 1831-32. But then it withered away to almost nothing in a very brief period during the middle 1830s. By 1837, there was not one anti-slavery society remaining in the whole South. Opponents changed their opinions or held their tongues. So we have the bittersweet truth about Virginia history that for a time it led the movement toward abolition while becoming a large post-1808 center of this country's internal slave trade in Richmond. Beginning in the 1990s, Richmond saw a vigorous public movement to remember and to memorialize that slave trade. Longtime Richmond resident Ben Campbell, in a recent set of public lectures, notes that it is not that slave trade of the mid-1800s in Richmond is not much documented in the history books, especially those that are used in high school students' classes in this state. Richmond in those 25 years was the transfer point for 300,000 slaves being distributed all over the South and the Caribbean in particular. But now, from the early 2007, we have seen an apology for slavery by the Virginia legislature, an example followed by five other state legislatures, including that of New Jersey. Good for New Jersey. Its state politicians remembered that slavery and varieties of racism always were national sins in the United States of America. It's a truth acknowledged too rarely by Yankee voices. To combine explicit pride and shame about one's collective past is no easy matter, intellectually, emotionally, and publicly. Back in 1962, in the midst of the great upset over integration of the University of Mississippi, a Mississippi-born Presbyterian minister named Robert Walker told his Starkville, Mississippi congregation about his recent visit to the Civil War battlefields of Virginia. It brought home to him, he said, the mixed goods and evils of both sides of that war, and especially its unprecedented destructions of life and property. All of it, he said, all the wealth piled high by slaves, all the clashing patriotisms of the two sides were not worth the carnage of those battlefields. When I first read that remarkable sermon, I wondered, would modern-day African Americans think that the death of 620 Americans was 620,000 Americans was a just cost to pay for the liberation of 4 million slaves? How very difficult the question is. How very necessary that we Americans learn to cope honestly with the retrospective thought, could that Civil War have been avoided while at the same time getting rid of that great curse of slavery? What Roger Wilkins of George Mason University calls the grating chain that snaked through the New Republic and diminished every life it touched. James Young, who was interviewed in a recent issue of a publication of this university, the Hedgehog Review, he makes a distinction between collective memories and collected memories. He believes, I think rightly, that when you set up a statue or some kind of a memorial and expect the public to come see it, you ought to expect also that different members of the public will have different views of that statue. The meanings are not inherent in the stone. They are brought to the stone as much as coming out of the stone. My favorite illustration of that these days is that statue of Arthur Ashe at the head of Monument Avenue in Richmond. Maybe you've seen it. Look, Arthur Ashe at the head of all those Confederate generals is a break in the alleged meanings of the Civil War. With David Blight and others, the analysis of how Robert E. Lee's statue began that line in 1890 makes a very interesting retrospect on how the South tried to recover from the Civil War by being proud of its leaders, many of whom gave good reason for being proud of them. But Arthur Ashe, that statue there, should remind almost any visitor to the whole of Monument Avenue that it was a general's army who is not pictured on that street who was responsible for Arthur's liberation of his own forebears. That mixes the picture of Monument Avenue, and I have to say it is a benign mixture, for it enriches what the history there means. For some, of course, the idea of revisiting history is a no-brainer. Not so, I have to say. All tribute to Gordon Craig, great modern historian of Germany, when he defines the obligation of historians to restore to the past the options it once had. If we cannot say of the acts of our ancestors, they should have done this and not done that, we deny to them and ourselves an attribute most popular in American ideology, namely freedom. Define it minimally as the power of contrary choice. In a country whose political rhetoric is peppered with celebrations of freedom, it is ironic that anyone would believe with Henry Ford that history is bunk, or that anyone would buy into the current cliche that dismisses the past by saying, oh, that's history. A fine recent example of what if history is in Nelson Langford's book, Cry Havoc, The Crooked Road to the Civil War. He analyzes especially the months of April and May 1861 in the state of Virginia, and he comes to this conclusion. What happened in Virginia and Maryland during the week after the surrender in South Carolina by General Anderson influenced history more fatefully than all the agitated demagoguery in the rest of the country put together. Events in those 2 weeks, 2 months, altered the political and military landscape in ways unimaginable at the beginning of the month. For a brief time, the balance could easily have tripped in another direction that is, Virginia not seceding from the Union. My colleague Kozuki Koyama, who was teaching in New Zealand when we invited him to Union in New York, reports that the Maori tribes in that country image their advance into the future by walking backwards, their eyes on the past, which we can know, while being uncertain about the future. We can only know by the clues of our past and present what the future might be. By contrast, says Carl Becker, Americans like to face bravely into the future like the engineer on a train who kicks up dust in its trail, dust that is not worth noticing. It can be a fateful mistake, as by that engineer in California who wrecked his train by looking too much at his cell phone. Well, if there's one nation on earth in which in recent decades has exemplified the reverse philosophy, it is Gordon Craig's specialty, Germany. From Germany and South Africa, the first two chapters of my book allege, Americans might learn some important lessons about how to combine pride and shame in one's national past, how to combine it in public ways which educate the future with hope that its citizens will neither repeat the crimes of the past nor ignore the citizens of the present whose ancestors suffered most in that past. Let me offer a few illustrations, first from Germany, then from South Africa, and finally from the United States. In 1999, in a visit to a high school or gymnasium 12th grade class, my wife and I heard several of the students speaking about summers they had spent in America and testifying to some negative impressions that they had, especially of America's celebration of July 4. All those flags, all those parades and marching bands, they said, it reminded us of Germany in the 1930s. And then the question students our own age would ask us, do you know what a swastika is? Know what it is? We've known about it almost from birth. The average American does know what Nazism is and was. What we're not so likely to know is how diligently for the past 40 years German leaders have tried to make sure that no future generation of Germans fails to know what Nazism and the Holocaust were. Said one of those students to us, we study that history three times in our 13 years of schooling. We study the Holocaust so often that you will find plenty of people in Germany saying, we've had it up to here with the Holocaust. But, she said, that evil was so deep, I think we may never get to the bottom of it. But we must keep on trying. I like what James Young says about the need that many of us have to do, which is memory work on some subjects in our ongoing history. In that interview of his in the 2007 Hedgehog Review, he pointed out how it is that some of our monuments do already invite the varieties of interpretation. He says these monuments might be called counter-monuments, or at least monuments which are permit very radical different interpretations. His favorite illustration is Maya Lin's Vietnam Monument in Washington, which is a place where one can celebrate the heroics of American soldiers and also mourn that the cause for which they gave their lives was not necessarily a great cause. Germans have a keen interest in American history, especially the history of Native Americans. They are prompt to call it a genocide, and they wonder why the real history of Native Americans gets buried in cowboy and Indian movies. I tell them we are doing better these days in the history books and in the movies, and I try to document that, but we have a long way to go. Is there, for example, any memorial in Charlottesville to the Indians who used to live here? So much as a street named after them? I do not know. Perhaps you can tell me later. As for Germany, it is hard to find a space in any German city which lacks some version of a memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe. Increasingly, German communities are finding leaders who press some version of the question, how did this local community collaborate in the crimes of Nazism? For example, a sculptor, Gunter Demnig, in 2003 began hammering out little brass plates for embedding in certain sidewalks of Cologne, Hamburg, Berlin, and other cities the fact that a Jewish family used to live here in this house. For example, one reads, here live Hermina Baron, born Lou, January 8, 1866, deported 1942 to Riesenstadt, murdered January 22, 1943. Not so comfortable living in the house with that marker on one's front sidewalk. Other markers are larger and more comprehensive in cities like Berlin. There is the mirror wall, the Spiegelwand, in the Berlin community of Steglitz, in the midst of the marketplace, engraved with the names of 1,700 former Jewish residents who left that upper-class community in the 1940s, never to return. They know the names of those sent off to the camps because the Gestapo kept very detailed records. That mirror wall is an in-your-face wall in a very literal sense. You cannot take a picture of it without photographing yourself. One of the wall's inscriptions asks the simple question, what to do? And you? The nearby upper-class community of Schöneberg now has 80 signs on various poles around their central plaza, each with quotations from the evolving anti-Semitic laws of the 1933-45 era, beginning with simple measures like restrictions on the acting profession and ending with the right of the government to order Jews out of their residences. I think of the 200-year history of Virginia legislation, which set in place the slave codes of the 17th century into the 19th century, and which, as a series of laws, deserve the same kind of memorialization. Someone has said that the Germans are not all that efficient, but they are very thorough. Once they decide to do something, they do it down to the last detail. It makes their armies hard to defeat. As regards teaching each other about the Holocaust, they've been doing it for 40 years. Ever since the university students of the 60s began to ask their parents and grandparents, what did you do between 1933 and 1945? It parallels, I think, the question that children, white and black, might now be asking their parents and grandparents. What did you do in the era of the Civil Rights Movement? The catalogs of German efforts to erect more memorials, to revise school curricula, to observe anniversaries, and to keep this history alive in political speeches, these catalogs are simply overwhelming. They run to several thousand pages. An account of my own first tours of Central Berlin, which begin my chapter on Germany, can be duplicated by any visitor to that city. Even on a first visit, you may participate in the sense of weariness at Nazi reminders that many Germans experience. Here is a bus stop whose shelter tells you that Adolf Eichmann had his office here. There, beside the Philharmonic Hall, is a memorial to people murdered for being too sick or too insane to qualify as good Germans. And down Unter den Linden is in the square across from the former University of Berlin, a glass square over a set of empty bookshelves buried beneath the pavement, reminiscent of the event in May 1933 in which students and faculty burned books by the thousands. Around that glass square, about this much square, there's a quotation from the poet Heine. Those who begin by burning books will end by burning people. Well, that is just a peep into the total work of public remembering that is still proceeding in modern Germany. Say that they are overdoing it. say that it all has not gotten rid of the slumbering and wakeful anti-Semitism of the country. Say even that Nazism was so evil that its legacy composes a burden on memory unique to Germany alone. Say all of that, and in so saying, you will be in danger of failing to identify the kinship between the misdeeds of another nation and the misdeeds of one's own. Visit modern Germany for a cure to the prejudice that is impossible for a nation to repent. Visit it for understanding that there is such a thing as the politics of repentance. That is also a reason for visiting modern-day South Africa. Alex Baran is right about the importance of good stories about our collective past. How can we have a society at all without something in our past to be proud of? But there is another more subtle quality of pride in a political culture. It takes the strength of that pride, perhaps, in order to make it possible for us to cope with the shame. We must somehow stand in the bright side to get the strength to look at the dark side. Surely Germany is a far healthier country for its now proven ability to acknowledge the evils in its past. Can you imagine what Germany's international relations would be if its leaders had said to the world, okay, Nazism is history, let's get on with the future and forget the Holocaust. One of these days in international relations of the United States, we may have to improve on our forgetfulness of the past with a great deal more honesty about our role in world history. You might begin with our 1900 invasion of the Philippines before we tackle the gross mistakes of our Iraq war. But the point is that it is possible to forge an amalgam of pride and repentance in a public account of one's national past, which is healthy all around. A good friend of ours in Berlin has paid a high compliment to my own work, like this current book, work on Germany's diligent trudge toward national repentance for Nazism, which I continue to find remarkable. Said my German friend, you helped make me feel that as a German, I am no longer in the dock, no longer on trial for the sins of my ancestors. It's really an expression of the old insistence of the Bible that if you confess your sins, forgiveness for them will be available. If you do not, you will not be forgiven. Hebrew Bible suggests that God will forget our sins, for God is merciful. But I see nothing in that Bible which suggests that God will forget the sins that the human has not repented of. In my first visit to South Africa in 1986, it was certain that the sins of racism in that country were heading either toward a civil war or some national political transformation that hardly anyone thought was possible. That the latter came is one of the overall good stories of modern history. In South Africa, that story seems right now under severe internal threat. But it's essential to note the importance of a device that South African politicians accepted in 1994 as the bridge between the old injustice and the new justice, especially that enshrined in the new constitution. They formed a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Ever since its work in 1996-98, TRC leaders have insisted that no one national model for public facing of past sins is to be imitated by other nations. Each has to wend its own way into the cleansing of amnesia with the tonic of honest memory. The really good story out of South Africa is the combination of that society's publicity for the evils of its past and new structures of justice that help ensure against the repetition of those evils. The good story of South Africa consists of its TRC and its new constitution. The makers of their new country insisted that the path toward the combination of shame and pride in their past would have to begin with a process of giving voice to the painful, bad stories of people who had suffered most from apartheid. That process had a double benefit. It abolished the readiness of white South Africans to minimize or ignore the suffering of the 4/5 of the population under apartheid. And it provided the victims of that system the therapy of telling their stories to a large, listening national audience. There are two levels of insult to the victims of gross injustice, you know. The first is the injustice itself. The second is for your neighbors to forget it. The torturers in South African prisons taunted their prisoners with the word, "Groan all you want. Nobody is listening, and nobody will remember you either." The latter is the final insult. If it did nothing else, the TRC opened the door to the bad stories as a way to open the door to the good story of full membership of all citizens in South African society. No sufferer of evil, racist law was too obscure a person to appear before that commission. Here was Lucas Sekwepere, shot, blinded, arrested on false charges, left with bullets in his neck. 10 years later, he recounts it to a listening national audience. And at the end, he testifies, "I feel what has been making me sick all the time is the fact I couldn't tell my story. But now it feels like I got my sight back by coming here and telling you the story." A very fine article on some of the problems of personal versus collective or collected memory by Jeffrey Olick in that same Hedgehog Review. He's a member of the Sociology History Department of this university. He says that it is impossible to suppress completely the evils of a past society. And rather than depending on a psychoanalytic process, I would join him in also depending on a social and political answer to the question, why is it that some bad memories can never be successfully buried in amnesia? No, somebody will remember. And that's how the re-remembering process sometimes starts, is because somebody talks about something that nobody else either wants to be talked about or which anybody really knew was there to be talked about. A truly free society makes free space for the untold stories of folk who have waited long to make those stories public. I fill many pages of this book with these testimonies. The variety of means for curing public amnesia are many in Germany and South Africa and in this country. Museums, statues, revised history text, new national constitutions, new laws, new freedom of the press. All of this has served forms of civic courage that are involved in digging up from the past what others thought were permanently buried. You can be human now in South Africa on a level long denied to 4/5 of its citizens, and that is a worthy thing to celebrate. But I hasten finally to American parallels. Those of us who insist that we cannot rightly recover from the sins of the past unless we rightly remember them can easily be dismissed as muckrakers, apostles of gloom, and oppressive moralists. This book tries to combat that reputation by practicing what I have come to believe is the most powerful example of the work, or in the work, of being a teacher. Over much of my experience as a student in public school, I was mostly led to fear being wrong. With her red pencil, the teacher did not hesitate to tell me what I did wrong. Against that is my certainty that as students, we are most likely to remember best those moments in the classroom when the teacher said something like, "Good job." A Harvard graduate in the 50s was asked in a sociological survey what his most important educational moment was at Harvard. He thought a bit and said, I think it was the time a professor wrote in the margin of one of my pipe papers, "Nice point. Teachers, take notice. Positive reinforcement works better than negative for learning." On that principle, I've tried in the latter chapters of this book to celebrate those events and trends in recent American history that show the coming of some new maturity in our public life as regards public attention to the misdeeds of Americans in our past. In his Confessions, Augustine of Hippo said, "There's something in humility that lifts up the head. There is something in confession of sins, private and public, that brings new dignity, new justice for persons and publics. My illustrations of that are legion. First, in the area of the long struggle of African Americans to see and to be seen as full citizens of the country whose ancestors enslaved their ancestors. In our own time, historians have done their proper work in great volume and integrity on this matter. Many of them are African Americans like Roger Wilkins of George Mason University. Another is Vincent Harding. I think especially the first volume of his history of the civil rights movement, There Is a River. In its opening pages, he recounts how in December 1865, a gathering of 2,000 newly freed slaves in Charleston adopted a proclamation which included the amazing words, "We are Americans by birth, and we assure you that we are Americans in feeling. And in spite of all the wrongs which we have so long and so silently endured in this country, we can exclaim with a full heart, O America, with all thy faults, we love thee still." The patriotism of many of us white Americans greets this testimony with pleasure, of course. But often enough, we fail to pause there before it in deep amazement. Not long ago, a black ethics scholar, a seminary teacher, exclaimed in one of our national meetings, "If there is a black American who has never had the thought, 'I want out of this country,' he grew up somewhere else." White Americans have a long way to go before we develop empathy enough to accept that testimony too. Had we developed that empathy, we would not have had so widespread horror at Jeremiah Wright's much-quoted sermon in which he says that many of his constituents would sooner say, "God damn America," as "God bless America." That so many still believe that, in Langston Hughes' words, "America will be," should be greeted with some humble amazement. Such amazement dawned on the decades, on some of us decades ago as we began to have the privilege of visiting black churches. The normal projection of some of us in our youth was to believe that in this segregated society we would be no more welcome in a black church than they were welcome in our churches. To the contrary, we were welcome, leaving one with the repentant feeling that the remarkable thing is not that white people are willing to welcome blacks into their company, but that for long blacks have been willing to welcome whites into their company. Getting to such a thought takes an appreciation of history, especially those dimensions of history which were left out of your high school history book, maybe even your university history. The classic work since 1976 on this score has been Edmund Morgan's Great History of Slavery in Virginia. He and Orlando Patterson of Harvard come down at the end toward the theory, which I must admit was for me the most painful theoretical conclusion of the study of slavery that I had ever encountered. What both of those scholars claim is that the origin of the notion of political freedom owed very much to the origin of political slavery. It was by looking at slaves that many people determined that they did not want to be slaves, that they wanted to be free, so that the negative was the background for the discovery of the positive. Morgan ends his book, "Racism became one essential, if unacknowledged, ingredient of the ideology that enabled Virginians to lead the nation into a new democracy in 1776. What a mixture of good and evil there is in that theory. I leave it to others to probe it some more. It is at least one of those possibilities that introduces new pain into one's sense of the past. In all four major chapters of my book, I have recorded changes in school history books which, over 50 years, have gradually included more realistic accounts of who benefited and who suffered in the course of American history. In the wake of the Civil Rights Movement, some widely used high school history texts tell facts that never appeared in predecessor books of the 1950s, not to speak of the ones in the 1940s that were in my high school. Now in the text on the names Nat Turner, Harriet Tubman, Henry Highland Garnett, Sojourner Truth, and Elijah Lovejoy. Chapters on the Civil War tell us that 180,000 freedmen served in the public armies, that 32,000 died, and 20 received the Medal of Honor. Reconstruction, the most neglected period in the history that most of us learn, gets the next 30 pages. But alas, for those of us who write books, their influence on public acknowledgement of evil's past can be slight without the supplement of other media. Film is one of them. We owe some great debts to dramas like Raisin in the Sun, Glory, and To Kill a Mockingbird. And then, like modern Germany, the addition of an anniversary or two to our national calendar. The Martin Luther King birthday is a great example. In addition to the gradual coming of a new revised memory, we can speak also of Christopher Columbus, the man whose discovery of America we celebrated last Monday. Prior to the year 1992, most of us imagined that we would have a great national ceremony around the 500th anniversary of Columbus' discovery of the Americas. I have put that discovery in quotation marks. Descendants of Native Americans, however, would not have it so. They succeeded politically in muting the celebration, especially as they brought to notice their own memories of Columbus and the work of historians like James Lowen of the University of Vermont. Haiti, for example, one of Columbus's first ports of call, probably had at least 3 million inhabitants in 1492. Thanks to the sinister slave trade and the labor practices initiated by Columbus, fewer than 200 were alive in 1542, and by 1555, they all were gone. Thus, James Lowen. Is there any wonder that Native Americans consider Columbus the villain in their history? Or that they would organize in 1992 to dampen other Americans' enthusiasm for that anniversary? Why not, I suggest in a late page of this book, turn Columbus Day into something like All America Day? And in doing so, to season our pride as Euro-Americans with the memory of the devastations as well as the benefits of the European arrival on these shores. Hence, therefore, the two great original crimes of American civilization, the near genocide of Native Americans and the enslavement of African Americans. I have described dozens of improvements in the acknowledgement of this history in Honest Patriots. Among the most remarkable are those recent occasions when whole communities have recovered the misdeeds, drowned in local amnesia in their history. Tulsa, Oklahoma, Rosewood, Florida, Abbeville, South Carolina, Richmond, Virginia, Oxford, North Carolina, the state of Oregon, and yes, New York City. In that city where I've lived for a third of a century, several years ago, we had a display in our local historical society of slavery in New York. It was in that display that this Southerner learned for the first time a vital bit of history, how in January 1861, the mayor of New York seriously proposed that his city secede from the Union along with the South. The cotton trade, you know, Wall Street. A long fourth chapter of this book dwells on matters which the author himself had to treat as a frontier between his knowledge and his ignorance of American history. You cannot have grown up in Eastern Virginia without knowing that African Americans are a living presence in one's own life. They are there, so to speak, around every corner. Not so Native Americans, at least those of us who happen to live east of the Mississippi, whence Andrew Jackson expelled all Indians in the 1830s. Down in Jamestown now, they are recovering the history of the Powhatans in the new museum there and in ways denied to my own childhood. It's a marvelous museum, and they set it up with improvements for the 400th anniversary of the 1607 settlement. But we all, as a public, have a long way to go on this one. As James Lowen puts it, historically, American Indians have been the most lied about subset of our population. That's why Michael Doris said that in learning about Native Americans, one does not start from point zero, but from minus 10. The inclusion of a chapter on this matter in my book is something of an act of intellectual repentance on my part. Some years ago in a seminar around my 1985 book on forgiveness in politics, a student said, "This would have been a better book if it had treated the case of Indians as well as the case of African Americans." He was right. In fact, the literature that treats the Indian case is vast now, and we have to be glad that in our public media, Indians get a fairer shake than they have gotten in most of our history. I think of the changing reputation of General George Armstrong Custer. In early 1991, at the lobbying of Sioux descendants of Sitting Bull, Congress changed the name Custer Battlefield to Battle of Little Bighorn. I have wondered if the 1970 movie Little Big Man had influenced the members of that Congress in their own earlier times. Now, of course, and at last, we have a museum of the American Indian on the Mall in Washington. There, plans for an even more belated museum of African Americans are afoot. But it remains true that for public consciousness in this field, we have a long way to go. An example local to the region where my family has a summer home in upstate New York is, for me, a good example. The Taconic Parkway stretches sort of parallel to the Hudson River all the way from the suburbs of New York City up to the vicinity of Albany. At the northernmost overlook of that parkway, you can look west across to see the entire expanse of the Hudson River Valley. The name Taconic is Mohican. At the uppermost overlook, you can see that all beautiful valley spread out, and you can also read a highway marker which tells how Henry Hudson came up the river in 1609 as the pioneer in the coming European settlements of the region. The marker notes the Dutch and the English plantations of succeeding centuries, with nary a mention of the Mohicans who once lived on both sides of that river, perhaps for 12,000 years. Those Mohicans welcomed Hudson and his crew with great friendliness and generosity, he later reported. Well, in 2009, New York State will celebrate a 400th anniversary akin to Virginia's recent one in Jamestown. And for that anniversary, a small collection of us in Columbia County expect to raise another highway marker in that overlook, acknowledging the former presence of those Mohicans who greeted Henry on his way up the river, soon to be named for him. It's a small gesture toward public education, but it's important. It will be another example of James Young's counter-monument, a monument that invites the viewers to reconsider something left out in the history that they may have been taught. A very promising small example came to my notice in reading the lectures of longtime Richmond resident Ben Campbell. He points out how on April 5th, issue of the Richmond Times-Dispatch, there is reported that in Charles City County, on the north side of Highway 5, there is now that 1 mile east of the Chickahominy River, a new highway marker, which gives a notice to the massacre of the Paskahaig Indians by Sir Thomas Gale, D-A-L-E, and some of the Jamestown settlers, who set a precedent that the Indians have remembered as a very bad precedent, namely the murder not only of the men, but also the women and the children of that tribe. Well, that's a very small thing, you might say, but I can tell you that those survivors of that tribe are very important. They about how important that small highway marker is going to be. Deanna Beecham, for example, of the Virginia Council on Indians, says, "There's a reason there's more than one perspective to history. Look at all the history, not just some of it. We're not trying to rewrite it. We're just trying to add to it." So, in researching this book on these three countries and their moving attempts to recover history, I had to myself endure a certain amount of expansion of the perimeters of my own mind on these matters. To learn to include other people in one's own sense of neighborhood after their exclusion is one task of honest patriots, especially in this era in which we're being challenged on every hand to consider that human beings, this globe around, are members of one community. The current economic crisis worldwide is a huge demonstration of the vices and the virtues inherent in globalization. We will take long to deal with this one. Training in the task of including all sorts and conditions of our fellow humans in our community takes place every day in these United States when we chip away at the walls that have separated us in mind and in deed from our neighbors near and far. There is a theology that fits this task. It prevents some of us from buying into a political philosophy which puts America first and which buries human identity in a nationalistic identity. The teacher in my education who best taught me this personal, social, political, and ethical dynamics of collective memory, was H. Richard Niebuhr of Yale. With his brother Reinhold and the theologian Jonathan Edwards, he is one of a trio that Martin Marty recently nominated as America's three greatest theologians. In his 1941 book, The Meaning of Revelation, he set forth the role of shared memory and shared forgetting in our common life. And I end with this quotation. "We do not destroy this past of ours. It is indestructible. We carry it with us. Its record is written deep in our lives. We only refuse to acknowledge it as our true past and try to make it an alien thing, something that did not happen to our real selves. So our national histories do not recall to the consciousness of citizens the crimes and absurdities of past social conduct, as our written and unwritten biographies fail to mention our shame. But this unremembered past endures. Our buried past is mighty. The ghost of our father and of the selves that we have been haunt our days and nights, though we refuse to acknowledge their presence. The conversion of the past must be continuous because the problems of reconciliation arise in every present. Groups use their separate histories as means of defending themselves against the criticism of others and weapons for warfare upon rival parties. We cannot become integrated parts of a whole until we each remember our whole past with its sins. No mere desire to overcome differences of opinion is of any avail unless it expresses itself in such reinterpretation and appropriation of what lies back of opinion, the memory. The measure of our distance from each other in our nations and groups can be taken by noting the divergence, the separateness, and lack of sympathy in our social memories. Conversely, the measure of our unity is the extent of our common memory. One of the reasons I wish that H. Richard Niebuhr could come back to life in truth is I would like at least to say to him, look, your teaching had some effect on me, and I have tried to express it in this book. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Shriver. We have a few minutes for questions and answers or a conversation. I know some of you will want to raise your hand, so please let's begin that now. Yes.
Yeah, you know, concept of repentance, especially in the Bible, is a very multidimensional matter. And to say you are sorry without rectifying what it is you are sorry for is not true repentance. And acknowledging the past, which is the heavy message of these writings, needs to accompany certain visible responses that you can call it affirmative action if you want to. Affirmative action has as its background an attempt to overcome in the present some of the injustices done in the past. So I have no way and have no knowledge enough or have the legitimacy to make any judgments about the University of Virginia on this matter. But if anybody thinks that the era of the need for affirmative action is over, we better look better at the facts. I must say, I think maybe in a shorter time and maybe with more actual progress, we have done better affirmative action for the equal rights of women than we have the equal rights of African Americans. I stand to be contradicted on that, but it's one of those things which we ought to keep alive and not act as though, well, we've had the civil rights movement, we've got the new laws and all that, but the new laws are only worth as much as we do to enforce them and to enact on them. And I think we in the private sector have a great responsibility on this. And I speak particularly as former president of a privately sponsored religious school, Union Seminary in New York. I know that this is a state university. But I'd be very interested to know, for example, did professors in this faculty help lobby for that apology for slavery in the Virginia State Legislature in 2007, January? And did they join forces with what must have been a new set of African-American legislators down there in Richmond? We would not have had those six apologies. if the voting rights law of 1965 had not been passed, resulting in having more blacks in all of those legislatures. So the political work of being sure that voice gets politically expressed in official places has been part of the work of doing some justice in our institutions. And I guess I'd have to say, as a churchman, that one part of the history of the past 50 years that for me is, has the densest mixture of pride and shame, is what the churches did and didn't do about the civil rights of African Americans. My father did not learn much about justice for African Americans when he was a student here, I have to tell you. Otherwise, we would not have had such arguments in our household in the era of Martin Luther King. That's a pretty roundabout answer, not a very good one, but, you know, I think we got to keep working at it. Got to keep working at the business of having more voices from the people whose ancestors had the suffering. It's important that some of us write and speak about those sufferings, but we are not in the first instance the authorities on those stories. Giving voice and space and time to those stories, I think, is very important.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions?
I'm a South African, and I enjoyed your coverage of the TRC. And we can testify to what a wonderful launch pad that was to building the new nation. My question is not about South Africa, but about the American media. I'd love to get some of your comments. So much of the media, television, and now it's not a good time to think about it. But so much of the media is concentrated on the soundbite and the station.
Yeah.
And there's very little appetite for food.
Yeah. As far as I'm concerned, you've answered that question in the same way I would answer it. I used to think that the coming of television was going to be a great new outburst of democratic dialogue in American politics. I no longer think that. And especially the commercial stations, whose primary purpose, even in telling the news, is to be sure that people keep on listening to that particular channel, and therefore their advertisers and their sponsors will continue to make profits. I don't think the commercial media have served us very well. And sound bites may get audiences, but they certainly do not illuminate complex political questions. I will say that I think in the 1980s, our media did better than might have been expected, giving voice to what was going on in the late 80s in your country. We learned firsthand from the television cameras about those riots in Joburg and other places. And somehow or other, that aided the divestment movement in this country and Americans' consciousness that something had to change in South Africa. Just so, I think, you have your own judgment on this, I think the televising of the TRC hearings in South Africa itself must have been educative for the country at large, for people who are willing to sit there and look at it. Those were important services of the media. I happen to think that we get our best political dialogue in the news reporting of PBS and not in the commercial. I do think, though, that the people in the television media do tend to overestimate their power in this matter. And I'll give you an anecdote about that. From 1986, that first visit I made to your country, I was invited there to be present in Desmond Tutu's inauguration as Archbishop of South Africa, the Anglican Church. Well, it was an event that the media from all over the world, especially the United States, wanted to cover. So they came into that St. George's Cathedral and started setting up their TV cameras up in the chancel of that cathedral. And Tutu came to them and he said, "No, you can't do that. That's a place where our ceremonies will take place. You'll have to be off on the sides and in the back." Well, they said, "Well, we can't get as good enough view." Afterwards, we heard that the television people went around mumbling, "It was because of this medium that we made Desmond Tutu a world figure. What right does he have keeping us from getting our best possible shots of this ceremony?" Well, you know, there had to be a Desmond Tutu before there could be a news program. There had to be a Martin Luther King before the March on Washington would have been there to photograph. In the writing of this book, I have developed new admiration for those minority people who insist on bringing to public view truth that has so long been buried. And I just think you're exactly right that our media does not, on the whole, specialize in telling truth, partly because truth is either unpleasant or too complicated to compress into any 30-second soundbite. Now, people in universities ought to be the first to stand up and demand that the media do better on that one. And I would myself have to take partial responsibility for not being active enough in that very field. But, anyway, thanks for that question, because I think what you've seen in this country is exactly right. Yeah. I wish I could answer that question with some wisdom, but I really don't have any. I will say this. In writing this, next to last chapter of this book, I came to a new admiration for the politicization of Indian affairs in the late 1960s and early 1970s. There's no question that you've got to organize to get the attention of politicians and the public itself, and that organization came to fruition in those years. That's when there was a shift in the movie projections of Native Americans. There are organizations and there are people. I really don't know what this Virginia Council on Native Americans is, but maybe they are people at least to be inquired about. They're the people who were very important for setting up that new marker on Highway 7 near the Chickahominy River. That it's like all politics, you know. You start and you see what you can do. Somebody has compared politics in American cities to spaghetti. They say you wiggle one strand and something wiggles on the other side of the plate, and you just keep on wiggling until you finally get to something you can count on as a way of doing it. And I don't think there's any substitute for participation in the political process for finding out what is possible. Frankly, in the current situation, where however you may be inclined to vote on the national election, the fact is that the Obama campaign has achieved a degree of organization, and especially with the use of electronic media, that is really astonishing. And I think you and your colleagues of the Appalachian nations may have to do something of the same thing. But that's pretty slight advice, I must admit. Way in the back. I speak as a former parish minister and something of a leader in the Protestant community. Protestant understanding of history leaps in about three different steps. One is the Bible. We take that pass very seriously. We study that book. Then we tend to leap over about 1,500 years of history to the Reformation. Calvin and Luther and their cohorts. From there, we do a leap into the present time. What we miss in the midst of all of that is a lot of understanding of present and nearby past and remote past and their relations to each other. Well, to make that a little plainer, I think we in theological education ought to be encouraging ministers to read a lot more history. And just sharing history with congregations. That amazing sermon of Robert Walkup in 1962 was full of history. And it was a counter history to the one that his Mississippi congregants mostly wanted to hear about. I think that the Christian pulpit in this country is the nearest thing to a place to utter freedom, free speech, of any place around. It's not utterly free because there is, I mean, back in that era when Walker was preaching, numbers of my friends were losing their congregations by speaking out what they saw was the truth about racial segregation. Nonetheless, I have to say to most ministers, entering into decent disagreement with your parishioners, including the interpretation of history, is something you have more freedom to do, probably, than do the professors in a state university. I speak from my 17 years of living in North Carolina, and the kinds of attack on free speech in that University of North Carolina by members of that state legislature. I just wish that my colleagues in the Christian ministry were using their bully pulpit, their weekly pulpit, to suggest a revisit to history from the standpoint of people not so much like ourselves. It's one of the reasons I admire so much Roger Wilkins' book, Jefferson's Pillow. That book is a great example of an African-American historian who is proud to praise Jefferson and Madison and Mason, and the other architects of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Declaration of Independence. He's just like Vincent Harding's account of those Charleston newly freed slaves. They're proud to be Americans, and so is Roger Wilkins. But he regrets with a deep regret that Washington and Jefferson and those worthies had some power to get rid of slavery, and they didn't do it. I know we could have a debate as to whether or not they really had that power, but it's a little hard for me to believe that they couldn't do it. And they could have done it at least with more freedom than the mid-19th century when slavery got more and more fastened on the economy of the whole nation by the huge burden of the cotton kingdom.
I'd like to ask a question. I'm afraid this will have to be our last question of the evening. Thanks to all of you for coming. This was such a wonderful conversation. I would just like to ask a bit more about the relation between the politics of memory and a theology of reconciliation. And I'm thinking of Martin Luther King's speech at the end of the Montgomery bus boycott year at Holt Street Baptist in November of 1956. The Supreme Court had just ruled in favor of the Montgomery Improvement Association, and at a meeting at gathering around the theme of Christianity and nonviolence, Dr. King told this jubilant audience, we must remember as we celebrate tonight that the end is not the protest. The end is not the boycott. The end is redemption. The end is reconciliation. And the end is creation of beloved community. And I'm thinking, about certain themes in your wonderful lecture. And, King might say that the end is not the monument.
Right.
The end is not the road sign. The end is redemption, reconciliation, and creation of beloved community. And so can you say a few words about the connection between sort of the politics of memory and the theology of reconciliation, or a theology of reconciliation?
Most of us have had the experience of finally saying to some other person something that hurt us or which we resent, and we've been afraid to say that lest the relationship be broken, only to find out that, it strengthened the relationship because the other acknowledged some sense of responsibility for a wrong, and because that was out in the open now, the friendship was both deeper and had a more promising future. Now, what is true in personal relations is not the same as what can be true in public relations, but I think that one of the great lessons of South Africa to us is precisely this. I mean, I happen to think that Desmond Tutu is one of the people in the world that's very difficult to dislike. And along with Nelson Mandela, they really are part of the communion of saints that I would celebrate. But both of those people neither one of them has ever compromised on saying that the apartheid system was evil. And by standing up for that truth, they cleared the air for a lot of people in South Africa, black and white. And in that, you might say, the aggression of that kind of politics, an aggression which was not violent at its best, the possibility of a new day, a new political day, was forwarded. Now, I know that there are those who want to take past history and the history of past wrong and use it like a club to beat people over the head. Such people often do not really want to reconcile. There is a profound difference in airing a painful truth for the sake of strengthening the bond between people and airing it just in order to give somebody else their just desserts and perhaps for them to be alienated. Alex Borain and I were having a conversation some time ago, and I said, the truth that leads to reconciliation has to be like a surgeon's knife and not like the knife of an assassin. It's still a knife, still hurts, but the aim of the surgeon and the aim of the assassin would be radically different. And for me, that's where it's the politics of the understood reasons for making a protest. The civil rights movement, after all, was a protest against what kept African Americans from being full-fledged citizens of the United States. And if it is clear that that is what you're after, you cannot be accused of simply causing an upset or fomenting violence and all. Getting people into the political act as equal citizens may have to be presaged by getting the public demonstrations going. And I'm very clear in my own mind about that, and it's one of those things where the understood reasons for breaking a public peace is very important to be clear about. And like you, Charles, I'm sure I had my share of arguments with people on that very point back in the 60s and in the 70s.
Thank you.
Thank you for your good listening.